You're listening to the West Coast Garden Girls podcast, a show dedicated to garden living in the warm and sunny coastal climates of California and surrounding states. And we are your mother-daughter co-hosts, Tamara and Leslie.
Hey, listeners, and welcome to episode 4 of West Coast Garden Girls. Today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about the different types of gardens. And garden types, if you will, can be categorized in so many different ways. They can be regional, cultural, aesthetic. They can be separated by color. They can be based on climate. They can be based on rituals, even. I mean, the list goes on and on. And we're going to try to go through as many as possible, and we'll probably barely still scratch the surface. I should note that the intention of this episode today, it's not to deep dive into each and every one of these garden styles, but to demonstrate that there is a huge breadth of styles and that it's not so black and white as many beginner gardeners tend to believe. It's also amazing that we live in the environment and climate and geographical location that we do. There's very little that we can't grow somewhere on the West Coast, because we have all these microclimates, all these different types of elevations. We have oceans and deserts and everything in between. And we'll start with the two that I think people tend to think are the most obvious, which is edible gardens and flower gardens. But then we want to talk about how there's so much more than that and how you can combine all of these different garden styles. So let's dig in. What do you say, Mom?
Let's go.
Let's start with edible gardens. There's so many people that just love this subject.
It's very on point right now. There are so many people who are trying to grow their own food, getting into whether they do it in containers or have a yard to dig in the dirt. Growing your own food is kind of a throwback right now to the Victory Gardens during World War II, when everyone was growing their own food. So let's start with that. And although we're starting with vegetables, I think these basic rules apply to flower gardens as well. Really, any plant that you want to put in your yard, you have to think about your sun exposure. Do you have enough sun? Are you in a lot of shade? What is your soil condition? What's your soil type? You also have to think about, what do you want? You know, what are you trying to get out of your garden? If you're thinking about a flower garden, you know, are you happy to have this big flush of flamboyant spring and early summer burst of color and then you don't care after that? Or are you trying to get a consistent color palette going throughout the year with different plants growing at different times, you know, a year-round type of garden? How much time do you have? How much effort do you want to put into your garden? Again, whether it's edibles or flowers, all these things have to be taken into account. What's your budget? How much money can you afford to spend? How much space do you have? And pay attention to how close you are. I mean, if you're thinking, I want to put flowers or vegetables over here, do you have an easy source of water over there? Is there a hose spigot close by that you can just turn on and water them? Or, you know, a drip system is a whole different discussion. But think about, before you do anything, whether it's, I'm just pointing this out because the rules are the same, whether you're going to plant vegetables and edibles and herbs or flowers that you want to dress up your yard, cut, bring into your home. All the, it's the same criteria throughout. So vegetable gardens. Most vegetables require full sun, and by full sun, I mean at least 6 hours of sun a day. So keep that in mind. If you have your heart set on a vegetable garden, but you happen to live in an area that is encumbered by fog or tends to get extremely cloudy, does not have good sun exposure, a vegetable garden is not impossible. There are a lot of plants that can still grow there. But be aware that you're probably not going to make awesome tomatoes, right? Tomatoes need a boatload of sun, but you can do a lot of greens, a lot of lettuces, a lot of herbs, a lot of beans. There are still a lot of vegetables you can grow in that condition. But just beware of what your yard offers you in the sun conditions and the shade conditions. And when you're looking at sun, you don't have to have consecutive hours of sun. I mean, you might get great sun exposure for 3 or 4 hours in the morning, and then there's a building or an obstruction or a tree or a hedge, whatever, that shades that area of your yard for a couple of hours, and then you get more sun in the afternoon. But as long as you're getting at least 6, 7, 8 hours of sunlight during the day, preferably before 4, 4:30 in the afternoon, you've got a good environment for growing vegetables. So what are some things you can grow if you are in a somewhat foggy, overcast climate? Again, pretty much most vegetables, but if you are really bent on growing tomatoes, which seems to be, tomatoes are the number one detailed, they've got the data, they've done the research, that is nationwide everybody's number one vegetable that they want to grow. You can still grow a number of tomatoes in that climate. You have to look for ones that are early season or mid-season, or settle on cherry tomatoes. Cherry tomatoes tend to do better in foggier conditions. Mm-hmm. Consider fruit trees. Think about planting fruit trees in your vegetable garden. So that's a start. And if you really want detailed information on your region, this is specific to California and particularly the Bay Area. But again, I think we mentioned her in an earlier episode, I really suggest that you get Pam Pierce's book, Golden Gate Gardening, because it will lay out for you, depending on where you live in the Bay Area, what kind of vegetables you can do. But the bottom line is, when you're looking at a vegetable garden, know exactly where you want to plant it, what your sun conditions are, what your soil conditions are, and what you think can thrive there. Yeah. And go from there.
Absolutely. And, you know, just really, really zooming out for our listeners on a very fundamental level, I think when a lot of people, and I mean mostly just beginner gardeners, when they walk into, say, their local nursery, the way that oftentimes these areas are merchandised, unless you really kind of deep dive into the signage and everything, is here's our section for things you can eat, and here's our section for things that are pretty to look at, right? And unfortunately, what this does is it kind of sets this expectation with gardeners that those are the two types of gardens that exist. And really, it's so much more sophisticated than that. It gets so much more granular than that. Another point is, I believe it or not, I hear this a lot, or I see this a lot, I guess, is people hear vegetable garden and they think, oh, I need to plant nothing but vegetables here. This is for vegetables. It can't have fruits. That doesn't include fruits. It can't include, you know, other herbs or something like that. And really what we should be referring to as vegetable gardens, the terminology we should probably all be using is more just edible gardens, because that's really what we're talking about when these nurseries are merchandising and have this type of signage up. And when you hear other gardening resources and gardeners talking about how they garden. So just that high level definition, I think, is important to point out. Similarly, flower gardens. So again, it's not so black and white. It's not just vegetable and flower garden, but Mom, can you kind of just give us the high level definition of a flower or a cutting garden? And then we can kind of deep dive into all the different styles that fall underneath these.
Well, it's a good point you made, because I'm going to back up to vegetable gardens for just a second, because I don't grow a lot of edibles. I try to grow. I'm very new into the vegetable gardening world, and I tend to concentrate on growing vegetables that I know I'm going to eat. I'm not going to grow something that I'm just going to toss into the compost pile, right? So I try to grow things that I'm going to eat. And when I think about that, when I start categorizing everything that I'm growing out there that ends up in my kitchen, I have to say 2/3 of it is herbs.
Yep.
It's not vegetables, it's herbs. You know, it is oregano, it's thyme, it's rosemary, it's basil. I mean, I could go on and on. It's dill. I mean, most of my garden, when I've looked at it, is actually herbs. So your point is well taken. And when you get into the flower gardens, there is no reason you cannot grow herbs in your flower garden. herbs have some beautiful flowers. I mean, think of a chive. I grow chives. I do cook with chives, but if you looked at my yard, you would think that I had chives for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I have them growing everywhere because in the spring, they have these beautiful blooms that look gorgeous with the roses. They look gorgeous with the wisteria. They just add color and shape and form to the overall garden. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about vegetable garden, flower garden, you don't have to separate those. You know, it's just that some people may not be at all interested in growing edibles and only interested in having beautiful flowers and shrubs and color in their yard. And that's perfectly okay. That's perfectly okay, which is why we're kind of separating these into edibles versus display flower.
Yeah.
Which is fine, you know, but you can mix and match, you know, get creative.
Yeah.
Do what appeals to you, right?
I train them sugar snap peas just because I love the pretty and fragrant white blossoms that come off. I don't really love sugar snap peas, but I grow a bunch of them because I just love those whimsical vines.
I love the flowers. Mm-hmm. I love the beautiful, delicate pastel flowers in the spring. Now I will harvest them, but that's not why I grow them. I grow them for the flowers. So if you want to plant peas in your flower garden, go for it. Absolutely. Do it. Same thing, you know, pay attention to what that flower needs. What does that plant need in the way of water, sun, fertilizer? Is it a hungry feeder? And just like with your vegetables and any planting, when you're planting flowers, you don't want to have something that requires a lot of water planted next to something that it will wilt. For example, lavender. You overwater lavender, it's going to die. Yeah. It's just going to look like crap. So when you're choosing your plantings, you have to pay attention to things like that. But moving on from that, I would say also think about bulbs. You know, don't discount bulbs in your flower garden, because you can plant bulbs in the fall that will come up in the spring, your daffodils and your tulips, and they're kind of the first harbingers of the end of winter. You know, they pop up in your flower border and your flower garden, and they say, okay, there's more good stuff on the way. As they start to die out, other plantings will kind of fill in, cover their ugly foliage, which tends to die down, but you can't remove it because those dying leaves are feeding the bulbs. But then in the spring, you can have other bulbs. You can plant other bulbs like dahlias that are going to come up in the summer and be a spectacular summer show. So you get season to season color in your garden, and you're planting for staggered bloom times. Now, if you don't care, if let's say that you're gone, you're on vacation, or you have a job that takes you away all of August, half of July and all of August, you don't care maybe what your display of flowers looks like. So you can discount that and go, okay, I just want flowers that look great from spring until the end of June. I'm happy. That's why I go back to my beginning comment, which is, what do you want? What do you want your garden to give you? It's not about what your neighbors are doing or what their yard looks like. It's what do you want for your yard?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, going back to high level, to your point, oftentimes flower gardens and cutting gardens, that terminology is used synonymously, because that sort of key differentiation between that edible garden and that flower garden is that the flower garden is intended for you to cut blossoms and to put together arranged bouquets and that you put in water. Or sometimes people just like to enjoy it, you know, from their window or from their yard or what have you. But that's sort of one way of looking at it, even though, of course, they can totally be blended, and there's, you know, a lot that sort of blur the lines between those two. So this next one, very relevant, particularly in California, honestly, beyond California, most of the West Coast. What about drought-tolerant gardens? How do we define a drought-tolerant garden? Why would someone want a drought-tolerant garden? And maybe what are a few varieties that are, you know, staples in that style of garden?
good point, especially when you think back 2 to 3 years ago when we were all rationing our water, taking buckets into our showers to collect water, waiting for the water to get warm, and then we could use those buckets of water to go water our plants, maybe not flushing the toilet as often as we normally would. I mean, we get on these extreme water conserving bends, you know, and it always happens after a winter of no rain. And I think we've all come to realize, even after years when we do get substantial rain or enough rain to tide us over for the next year, we get kind of lazy, but in the back of our minds, we still know that we live in high desert. You know, where we live in California is basically some form of desert until you get up into the mountains. So it's the new norm. It's the reality. It's we all have to be respectful of how we use our water resources. So drought tolerant gardens have become very popular. A lot of people have gotten rid of their lawns. We talked about that in an earlier episode, or if not getting rid of their lawns entirely, greatly minimizing them. People have made great strides in being mindful of how they use the water that's available to us. So drought-tolerant gardens, basically, I mean, in a nutshell, you are just choosing plants that require very little summer water. And I say summer water because in our Mediterranean climate in California, our rainfall comes in the winter, you know, we'll just say November through March on average. We get our wet season is winter, but we don't want to waste a lot of water in the summer when we don't have rain watering our plants. So we're looking for plants that thrive on winter moisture and survive. They might not look beautiful in the summer, but they will survive the summer with very little and sometimes no water at all, and then revive after a good winter of rain, you know, or at least a decent winter of rain. So I would say it doesn't really matter which state you live in. If you look towards your native plants, native plants have learned how to adapt in their environment. They know how to live, in our case, on very dry summers, hopefully wet winters. If you go further north up to the Pacific Northwest, you'll have native plants that perhaps thrive on a lot of winter rain, maybe moderate spring rain, still dry summers. I mean, you have to look at your own environment, but native plants survive well. I mean, they've adapted to our location, and there are many of them that have become, what would I say, not hybridized. I mean, there are nurseries that specialize in propagating these plants for the residential garden. You know, so, I mean, some plants don't necessarily translate easily from the wild to residential, but a lot of them do. And nurseries have figured out which ones thrive, which ones don't. I think the key is to make sure when you're planting a native, that you're planting a native that exists in its natural form, I mean, out in the wild, in a condition that is comparable to your environment. Because I've made that mistake. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at native gardens, we talk about plant communities. So in California, there are at least 8 different plant communities, and I'm not going to list them all here for you. But for example, where I live, it would be considered chaparral. Okay, that's my plant community. Where you are, Leslie, I would say it's more coastal scrub. That would be your plant community. Mm-hmm. Well, if I go and get a plant from your community and try to make it thrive in my yard in Livermore, it's going to be a disaster and vice versa. So when you're looking at natives, you know, pay attention, get informed, figure out which plants cater to where you live and go from there. Go to local plant nurseries, you know, native plant nurseries and check it out.
Yeah, the one that's in our area, and I think I might have mentioned this on a previous episode, but there's a nursery in San Francisco called Bay Natives Nursery. And that is a place that you can definitely depend on the varieties being sold there being truly native, at least to the San Francisco proper area. I mean, we can do an entire episode on how to define natives, how to source the correct natives, what, you know, what, how do you categorize natives, what's safe, what's not. And we will. But that is a good place to start when it comes to using natives in your drought tolerant garden. I will also say there's always that succulent garden trend that is just so popular in cities up and down our state, which is just all succulents, gravel, a lot of hardscaping, which is a very, very drought tolerant garden. And obviously succulents are very, very drought tolerant plants. Personally, that aesthetic's not for me, but that is probably one of the most common types of drought tolerant gardens that you're going to see in major cities across the country, really.
You know, I think that really took off because when you look at millennials, they love to travel. I mean, one of the top things on their list of fun things to do and goals when they set yearly goals, they list places they want to go see, you know, countries they want to go visit. And succulents are the perfect plant for them because you can water them and disappear and come home and there they are.
Yeah, they're the outdoor cats of the plant world.
Makes sense. It makes sense.
These next garden styles, they're a little bit more granular than those big three ones of, you know, edible gardens, flower gardens, and drought tolerant gardens. So we're going to move through them a lot faster because there's just so many of them and we're only going to scratch the surface, like I mentioned earlier. But why don't we start with a shade garden?
Shade gardens are tricky. There aren't a lot of plants that I'm familiar with, and maybe they're just tricky for me because I have a yard that is in constant sun. You know, I fall in love with plants and I swear I'm going to make them work in my yard and they don't. They die because they need shade and I can't give them shade. So I am not the expert on shade plants, but there are things like hellebores, ferns, heuchera. Heuchera is also known as, I think, million bells is the common name for them. They all like shade. What are some other ones? See? Not my special.
Well, you know who is a pro at this and who has, you know, 26 other books on the subject is Ken Drews. He wrote a best-selling book called, I believe, The Shade Garden or something along those lines. I'll figure out what the name is and I'll put it in the show notes. But shade gardens are his specialty since his garden is in the very hot summer climate of New York. So we can always do a bit of a deep dive into the content of that book and come back around to it. But just so our listeners are aware, shade gardens are quite literal. They're gardens that are designed to either create shade, but mostly they are planted with shade tolerant plants. So if any of you have a lot of building or tree cover or something that's causing your available yard space to be covered in a lot of shade, then a shade garden is probably the direction that you want to go, unless you want to start chopping some of those trees down, which I imagine you don't. Let's talk real quick about a meadow. How do we define a meadow?
Meadow gardens have become more popular with the advent, again, of drought tolerant plants, getting rid of the lawns. Your regular turf lawn has come under a lot of condemnation because it takes a lot of water to keep it looking good. People joke about how we water our lawns to make them grow, and then we come out every weekend and mow them down. And then we fertilize them to make them grow. And we come out every weekend and mow them down. Anyway, high maintenance, a lot of weeding. They've become out of favor. They still serve a purpose, but in their place, meadow lawns have become more popular. And that's really just using grasses to replace your lawn. I mean, you can use anything to replace your lawn, but if you want that lawn type of aesthetic, a lot of grasses are used. They're low growing. Some of them you can mow. Actually, all of them you can mow, or sometimes people just choose, if they're a low growing mound, they just leave them as a low growing mound. And it can be very pretty, really. At what the meadow gardens do is give you a sense of movement, because mm-hmm. the grasses in the wind, they sway, they shift. It's almost like looking at the waves in an ocean.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be confined to one specific grass. You can mix up your grasses. You can also plant bulbs down below in the dirt, you know, in the soil underneath all of your grasses, that will come up in the spring or in the summer, whatever their time frame is for blooming. So it gives you a more naturalistic look to your meadow. You can mix up your grasses. One of my favorites is a Muhlenbergia. It's called Pink Muhly, M-U-H-L-Y, Pink Muhly. And it sends up fabulous sprays of pink plumes in the fall. And if you plant that in masses, it's just a showstopper. It's gorgeous. So you can sprinkle that. You can incorporate that into a patch in your meadow garden. But that's where the meadow garden has kind of taken off. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple, if you want to get books on that, I'll have to get you the details for you to put into the show notes. But Pete Udolph is a landscape designer who uses that concept a lot. There's another one. Anyway, there are great books. I mean, I don't pretend to know all about all of this, but I do have good resources to send people to if that's a direction you want to go in.
Okay. Yeah. We'll definitely add those to the show notes. And I don't have enough space to really be a professional in meadows, but I do know that I love them. I do know that I love the movement. And I do know about a company called American Meadows that sells meadow mix, which is just like you said, it's a mixture of those natural grasses, but it also contains oftentimes native plants. For us, that would be something like poppies mixed with, I don't know, some sort of blue fescue or something like that. And they're really gorgeous. It looks like that quintessential meadow that you would see in, you know, coming from The Sound of Music or something like that, even though meadow is a much broader, there's a much broader definition than just that one type of visual that maybe comes to mind. But yes, very, very good option for drought tolerance. Since our first episode, a few people have actually asked me, what is a moon garden? And so I'm happy to explain that in greater detail, because that's essentially what I started growing in my own yard. Pretty literal in definition as well. It's a garden that is designed to be enjoyed in the evening, typically under moonlight. Can't be absolutely pitch black outside for you to enjoy a garden, at least visually. But the types of plants that you put into a moon garden are ones that either reflect moonlight or other types of light sources in the evening. These can be things that have a lot of silver foliage, that are already light in color, things that just aren't going to blend into, you know, the ground or your fence line. They can also be things that activate or are very visual or attract pollinators at night. So oftentimes these are white blooming plants. And the reason why white blooming plants are so, so fragrant is because they have to be. They need to be attracting pollinators at night. And so they need to be the most high contrast that they can possibly be when it's dark outside, and they're attracting things like moths, they're attracting things like night flying insects, things that are trying to avoid predators during the day. So the result is oftentimes a very monochromatic garden, right? You've got a lot of silver leaf plants, you've got a lot of white blooming flowers, and deliberately not much else. So that's what a moon garden is. It's great for people that maybe have a long commute, and so they can't really enjoy their garden during the day. It's great to just have a part of your garden be a moon garden if you want a sort of oasis that you can enjoy at night. And it's great for people that love fragrance, which I certainly know I do. And that kind of brings us to another type of garden, which is a scent garden, which is something that you can enjoy both during the day and at night. But those two types of gardens are oftentimes very synonymous simply because white blooming flowers are so wonderfully fragrant. Again, Ken Drews wrote a wonderful book on this called The Scentual Garden, S-C-E-N-T. And we'll link that book in the show notes, and I'm sure we'll bring it up numerous times because you and I both have it.
I love the idea of incorporating fragrance into your plantings anywhere in the garden, but specifically, most importantly, places where you've put chairs, benches, one chair, a stoop, it doesn't matter, someplace where you can hang out and really enjoy it. Just places near where you walk, where you enter, or just want to go hide out in a corner.
I have a sniffing stump for sure. It's just for me to sit in and smell whatever it is that happens to be blooming during the time of year. Okay. The word topiary, I don't think everybody knows what that is or what that means. So can you give a quick definition to what is a topiary?
Topiary is using plants. It's usually some kind of a hedge plant, a boxwood, a dense green, evergreen shrub that gets pruned, shaved, carved into a shape. Usually animals, that's a very common one, is they will take it and turn it into a giraffe or whatever the theme is that they're trying to create. So it's shaping shrubbery into specific forms, not the form that they would normally grow in. It's certainly not a naturalistic shape. You know, think of an ice sculpture. This is a plant sculpture. That's basically what topiary is. And it's a lot of fun. It's a specific taste. And you just need to be aware that if you're going to do it, you have to stay on top of it. I mean, once you let it go and you stop shaping it and pruning it, it's just going to turn into, you know, suddenly your cute little dinosaur looks like some deep thing, fish with enormous gills, whatever, from the deep, deep, deep sea. So you, once you start, you have to commit.
Yeah.
But it can be a lot of fun. And sometimes topiary is as simple. I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure, have seen in front of homes and in parks where they have shaped bushes into balls, into big globes. And sometimes it'll be a large globe on the bottom, a medium globe on top, a small globe on top of that. Think of a snowman, maybe, but that kind of a shape. So it's not an animal. It's nothing that you would look at and say, oh, that's a fill in the blank. It's just how they've shaped the shrub, but that still is topiary.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more. And gosh, like I mentioned, there's so many different styles of gardens, different way of thinking of how you categorize these styles. But why don't we throw it in there? Because I know a lot of people love this subject, which is container gardens.
Container gardens are a topic unto themselves, but they are very important. And especially right now, when a lot of people are just starting to get into gardening and don't have a lot of space, they may be in an urban environment where they don't even have ground to dig in. It may be completely paved. That's all they have in their yard. It doesn't mean they can't have a garden. Container gardening will fill that need, and you can be very successful at it. It's a matter, again, of the basic rules don't change. It's like, where is your sun? Where is your shade? What do you want? What do you want to grow? It can be flowers. It can be edibles. It can be nothing but herbs. It can be small trees. You can plant Meyer lemons, kumquats, loquats, you know, you pick it. Small citrus, dwarf varieties, not have any vegetables at all. You can pretty much grow anything in a container. And the only limitation is your space and your sun exposure. That will dictate what you can plant. Flowers, anything. But that's a whole other episode.
Yeah. And we will. We'll definitely do a deep dive on that one, because I know a lot of our listeners really don't have a lot of space to work with. Like you mentioned, it's just a little balcony, and container gardens are the best solution for people that still want to get into gardening, but don't have soil in the ground that they can really, you know, utilize. So we'll do a dedicated episode to that, as we will also do dedicated episodes to all these other styles, everything from, oh gosh, butterfly gardens to a greenhouse, planting inside of greenhouses, or maybe just indoor gardening in general. We talked a little bit about herb gardens and we talked a little bit about natives, but there's so much more than can be said about that. There's everything from water gardens for attracting dragonflies to Zen gardens planted with Japanese varieties to minimalist gardens, poison gardens. Don't know why you would have that, but anyway, you name it. So we will do our best to deep dive into every one of these garden styles over the course of time. We will try to prioritize styles that really are in high demand or are most relevant to the West Coast. We'll start there. And yeah, we'll explore each and every one of them in a lot more detail. And that'll probably be our next episode too. We're gonna take just one of these garden types and we're gonna explore it in a much more granular way based on popular demand. What do you say about that, Mom?
We'll do it.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much for tuning in, listeners. I know this was a bit slightly longer of an episode, so hope you're still with us. And we are looking forward to catching back up with you again next week. Again, you can always follow along with the things that we're planting in our garden, how things are progressing, by following us on our Instagram. And that's at West Coast Garden Girls. That's girls plural on Instagram. So we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much, Mom.
You bet.
Our theme music was produced by the amazing DJ Houseplants, and our podcast was recorded and produced by us in our respective closets. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, and you can follow us on Instagram at West Coast Garden Girls. Talk to you again soon.